Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to With Insights. I'm your host, Iggy Garcia, streaming live on the World Wide Web, on withinsightsradio.com, on the Blog Talk Radio Network. For the next 60 minutes, we will be learning about With Insights. All our friends on this show have something to share, something to give. So I want you to sit back and relax, fasten your seatbelts, and let's get ready for the ride.
The smooth sounds of Clancy Pretzel Rod. I want to welcome everybody to With Insights Radio. I'm your host, Iggy Garcia. I'm here with David Two Crows, Katie Singing Eagle.
Hello.
We're here broadcasting live in Columbus, Ohio, on a nice rainy day.
A great weekend, though. Didn't we have a good weekend?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I'm beat up by it now. If I sound a little hoarse to you, it's because we just had a great time.
Too much hooping and hollering.
Too much hooping and hollering.
Yeah.
Drumming.
That drumming out at the All Life Integrative Wellness Center was just amazing.
Yeah, it was off the hook, yeah. I loved it. It was a great time.
We always say that, but y'all ought to come out and join us sometime.
Yeah, it's a blast. And then we're going to be at the horse farm this weekend,
Liberty Horse Farm.
Over there off of Fisher Road. Stuck up.
So that was Saturday night. And then Sunday you did the Tippy class and ceremony out at Mount Sterling.
Yeah, that was pretty intense. You know, I wasn't, number one, I wasn't feeling well. I was kind of down, you know, physically in my body. I could just feel the moon pushing on me. But we got her done. We built it in Mississippi. You know, we built the structure. And then after that, you know, we went for a little lunch break, and then we came back, started the fire, and put the blankets on, and we went at it. And, you know, went instructing, giving instruction, you know, throughout the Mississippi itself, the course of the doors. And it was a nice weekend. I'm tired, but it was worth it. It's worth it.
Yeah,
where there's things I had to process, things I'm still processing. So that's what we like. But what about besides you guys? What have you been doing?
Well, like Sunday when you were doing the Atsipi ceremony, I was performing a personal house blessing for a relative of mine that went really well. She'd asked me through Lori to come and do that, and I was really honored to do that. And it was fun. Got a couple of the children involved as well, you know, in going around and doing it, but. It just shows that there's a hunger out there, you know. There's a need for people to connect with ceremony and that it's becoming honored again, you know, that aspect of our lives. So I was very honored and happy to do that.
Very good. And Katie, you were kind of tag-teamed with me, so
yeah,
I'm sure you had your different version of
Mount Sterling. Yes, it was something building a Mississippi from scratch. I'd never done it before.
Yeah.
It was already done the structure part of it, and I helped cover the last time and bring the stuff around and the stones and all that, but I never helped with the structure itself about putting the twine around the branches and helping to hold it in place while that was being done. So that was hard work.
Mm-hmm. And it tests you, you know, mentally too, you know, when you're trying to build, you know, cross the rods together, or the branches together, and tying them up, and everybody has to work together on this.
Yeah, so
I built one by myself. Mm-hmm. It's harder by yourself, trust me.
Yeah,
because you gotta have counterweights and stuff. But when you work with a group of people who really are enthused about doing it, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
It was still tough because we had to make decisions. And we were all joking, "Let's go start an Mississippi building business." I'm like, "No,"
and
everybody's like, "No, this is enough. We're just coming." Because it was hard work.
Right.
It was hard work.
Well,
really,
you've had a goal, too, of putting Mississippis around the state, too, in different places. So
it's getting closer.
There'll be plenty of chance to have some experience with that.
Absolutely. Well, talking about Mississippis,
okay,
the man who knows Mississippis better than maybe myself is on the other line, and he's going to join us here in a few minutes, Chief Philip Cloudpiler. He's of the Nemenhaw Church, the Native American Church of Nemenhaw. We changed our name, so we want to make sure that we get that correct. He is actually the president of the religious aspects of the church.
Okay.
And his son is the EPMC of, I believe the secular side, right, of the church. So there's two branches of the Nemenhaw. So
that's a pretty recent development, too.
Yeah, and he'll be able to explain that a little bit better. We're going to act like we don't know anything, because a lot of our listeners don't know anything. So we're going to ask questions, and I hope Clockbother understands that. I'm sure he does. But we're going to proceed forward and bring him on the line.
Well, let me give a little background, too, as you're bringing him on the line, that we're talking tonight about the Myers test, which some people might confuse with the Myers-Briggs personality test, but it's not. It's actually comes from the decision, the U.S. versus David Myers, back on November 14th of 1995. Mr. Myers was attempting to establish legitimacy for his Church of Marijuana, and he was facing a couple of charges resulting from possession and use, and claimed religious exemption for that usage under what was the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or RFRA. And so the judgment that came down from that basically outlined what we're going to talk about tonight, which is the Myers test. The U.S. District Court Judge Clarence Brimmer brought up some points, to help to outline or identify the aspects of a religion and as is considered under federal law. So those are before us now, and we can kind of go through them, but okay. I turn it back over to you.
With no further ado, we'd like to welcome Chief Cloudpiller to the show.
Well, thank you.
Welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. Thanks for being on with us.
You're most welcome.
Well, you kind of heard a little bit where the show's kind of leading, a little bit about the Myers test. We've actually learned a lot of this. We talked about a little bit about Great Council, and we're kind of asking people to get on board and to learn and to understand this information. I guess we want to open the floor for you to just kind of explain things and where the direction the Nemenha are going and what you're looking for, what the future looks like for the Nemenha.
Well, I think the context is important because in Native American churches, no matter which church you decide to examine, to observe or look at, you're going to find that aspects of natural healing, or what we call emergence, are common to all of them. So this is a problem for courts who have to take a look at, they have to examine the possibility that a person has broken the law, and they have to decide whether that's happened or not. And in many states, and probably very soon in most states, natural healing is only going to be, the practice of it is only going to be allowed to those who are licensed by the state. And that's just happening. But the problem is that if your religion believes that a essential sacrament or sacred object or practice of the religion is natural medicine, where does that put the practitioners of such religions? The court and the government cannot felonize or villainize the practice of religion. ARFRA has provided for that. But how does the court distinguish between what really is the practice of religion and what is not? So in the case of David Myers, he made a deal. He conspired with his partners beforehand and said, hey, look, if you guys get caught, you go ahead and you point the finger at me because I have a religious freedom defense all worked up. And so they did. They were actually bringing marijuana in from Mexico, and they were distributing it, and it was a pretty good little deal. They were making some good money, and they thought they had it made. And when they were caught, they did finger their friend, and they got the other two partners got lesser convictions or lesser sentences. Myers went into court and said, threw this up. I am the president and founder of the Church of Marijuana. This is the practice of religion, and you've burdened my religion. The judge was right. The judge was very thoughtful and mindful. He pulled everything back, and then they had to determine. They had to observe, and they had to assess, and they had to reassess what was actually going on there. And the reason that this is important is because the court can't have an opinion about religion. It can't get on that slippery slope of telling the citizens what's right and what's wrong, what is correct, what's error, what's righteous, and what's wickedness. Freedom of religion was built into the Constitution in this country because of essentially the Salem witch trials. So the court, neither the court nor the government can play favorites when it comes to religion. So here's a guy who, had it all worked up. He was all ready. He thought to claim that he could substantiate the recreational use, sales, distribution, manufacture, and all those things of marijuana and get away with it. And so the judge stood back and they actually recessed for quite a while. And they had their paralegals and all their clerks of the works, and they have lots of them, go into an extensive research all around the world in court cases where the courts approached the definition of what is religion and got opinions from everywhere and basically came up with what we now call the Myers test. And in the end, Myers lost because he couldn't establish that he had the accoutrements, the bona fide real accoutrements of religion. Now, whether this will ever stand up to a, you know, to a Supreme Court test is still up in the air. But at this point, everybody who lays claim to an ARFRA-type defense for the practice of their religion must prove, they must establish and demonstrate with a preponderance of evidence certain aspects, or that they have the accoutrements of religion before their activity or their practice can be determined religious or not. Now, ARFRA demands two things of the accused. If you're going to use an ARFRA defense, and that's Religious Freedom Restoration Act, you have to first prove that your belief is religious, and second, that you are sincere in your belief. The Myers test is the test by which the court decides whether it is religious or not. And that's the import here, because there has to be a way to triage the bad guys from the good guys, right? We're good guys. We don't want the bad guys taking advantage of or using and exploiting a law that is designed to restore our religious freedom, and that's the gist. That's the reason that we respect the Myers test, whether we agree with every aspect of it or not.
Very
that
good.
Make sense?
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. So I'm just going to run down some of these, if you don't mind, just going to kind of go 1, 2, 3, 4 and see what you have to say about how the Nemenha might address each of these points. Is that's all right?
Sure, that's great.
Okay. So the first one is ultimate ideas. Basically, religious beliefs often address fundamental questions about life, purpose, and death. As one court put it, a religion addresses fundamental and ultimate questions having to do with deep and imponderable matters. These matters may include existential matters, such as man's sense of being, teleological matters, such as man's purpose in life, and cosmological matters, such as man's place in the universe. How would you say that the Nemenha would approach that particular point?
Well, the Nemenha Church is based on a belief that we are all relations, that we're all created relations, we're related intrinsically, both spiritually and physically, with all other created things. So when we don't have time in this in one talk show to talk about cradle to grave, the beliefs of the Nemenha, but one thing is very 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 certain, and that is that we do address fundamental, what we call metaphysical aspects. In other words, the Nemenha Church teaches and promotes things that you couldn't really call merely a way of life, or a philosophy, or a science, but rather we do address what is religiously held by our people, but can't necessarily be explained by science. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think that's where they're going with this. If, you say, biology, the functions of the body are part of the doctrine of our church, well, you don't have to have a doctrine of a church. You don't have to go to religion to find out what the functions of the body are. So the church or the court is attempting to draw a distinction between philosophy and way of life and actual religion. They're approaching the concept of, and they use the term imponderables. That means that you yourself are going to have to ask somebody. You're going to have to go and seek service, ceremony, sacrament, something, some instruction from somebody else to get these things. And that's what churches do. Mm-hmm. They teach things that you can't learn in, public school.
Right. Okay. Next one addresses metaphysical beliefs. That is a reality that transcends physical and immediate apparent world. So more than just this plane of existence, this life that we're living in now, this physicality, does the Nemenha look beyond that as a group, as a philosophy, as a religion, so to speak?
Most definitely. And as you know, in the Constitution and the Menhal, we have one requirement. There are many requirements, but one of them that stands out in this context is that we, none of us as ministers, are really allowed to dictate the actual personal beliefs of any other minister. And the reason for that is that we rely upon a principle known as Wayekin in the ancient tongue, and that means that when we receive our sacred call to healing ministry, we receive it by a revelatory power. It didn't come to us in the mail. It didn't roll down to us through university. We can learn things about healing, but the actual call to minister comes through spirit. It is entirely metaphysical and cannot come through another person. And so that's one example of the fact that, you know, we really, really rely upon a revelatory power. You're talking about Itsipi, and Ignacio, you mentioned you had a lot to process. Mm-hmm, one of the reasons
yes.
we go into Itsipi is because it sets us outside of the natural world and puts us in a position where we sacrifice, knowing that we may, you know, under normal circumstances, we're placing ourselves in a dangerous physical position.
Mm-hmm.
Normally, when your hand gets too close to the fire, you pull it away. Well, we crazy people are crawling into the Itsipi with the understanding that we are going to be asking for assistance from heavenly beings and receiving such assistance. These are some of the teachings of the Namenha that transcend the physical and get into the metaphysical. The judge or a prosecuting attorney general, who have you, is never going to be able to explain a revelation or a personal insight. Where does that knowledge come from? Where did you look it up? What book transmitted that information to you? Well, no, I processed that in Itsipi and received from my ancestors, you know, heavenly beings, that information. That's something the court can't have an opinion about, and that's what they're talking about here.
Right, right. Very good.
Now, number three, I know the answer to this one, I think, so, but I'm going to ask anyway. A moral or ethical system, a particular manner of acting or way of life that is moral or ethical, also certain acts of, in normative terms, such as right or wrong, good or evil, or just or unjust, prescribing those acts that are wrong, evil, or unjust, and creating duties often imposed by a higher power, force, or spirit that cause us to act in the right manner and do walk sacred, talk sacred, so to speak.
Right. We believe very strongly in consecrating our walk and consecrating our talk. One of the most telling things in our behavior that we absolutely require of our ministers is the concept of first do no harm. First do no harm does not mean that you may not be using, say, for example, a sacrament that causes enough irritation in the bowel to cause a cleansing. There are those who would say, hey, you're hurting someone, to help them. That doesn't mean, that doesn't breach the first do no harm, but first do no harm means that you don't race to the dangerous procedures first. You exhaust all other physical and spiritual options before opting for something that might injure someone. Also, if a person in the so-called operation or execution of their ministry actually makes injury upon somebody, they're expelled from the family. So these are areas that qualify the Namenha under the Myers test in this context.
Right. Very good.
Certainly not the only, but they're good examples.
Mm-hmm.
First, do no harm, walk sacred, talk sacred, wayekin, that sort of thing.
And on number four, I think this is one that the judge in his later writings really got on Myers about, was the comprehensiveness of beliefs, that there's more than just one question or single teaching involved in the philosophy or the religion that's being presented. That it's got layers to it, that there's you know, more knowledge to be had than just through one lesson or one teaching. So I know that Nemanja addresses that as well.
Yeah, you got to bear in mind that Myers, his only doctrine was that in order to be saved, you have to smoke marijuana. There was one doctrine, one sacrament, one decision, one reason for being, and that was, if you don't smoke marijuana, you're damned. You go to hell. And that's not really necessarily a qualifying requirement. It's more a disqualifying requirement. So it's one way that the court can sort out whether somebody is trying to justify an illegal act or whether they are trying to establish by preponderance of evidence the existence of religion.
And we as Nimenha, we draw our teachings from an actual archive, an actual written record, as I understand it, too.
Much of it, yeah. It's the entire reason for the Nimenha existence comes out of a work of translation of ancient origin. Nimenha is an ancient term and comes from an ancient people who occupied, along with many other peoples, but occupied the North American continent before white conquest. Those teachings, it's a religious archive, doesn't have a lot about, you know, their political lives or, you know, touches a little bit on their workaday lives, but for the most part, it concentrates on the religious history of the people through about 1,000 years of history. And we do. We draw much of our doctrine, our creed, our code, what we do, how we say things. We draw much of it from the archives. It inspired the entire program. The Nimenha is a restoration of an ancient people that disappeared, almost disappeared, pretty close to disappeared. I mean, there are descendants that are still around, but as is the case with many, many, many of the tribes that fell under the thumb of the federal government, they almost entirely lost their culture and their religion. This was actually in the process of restoration before the Nez Perce War and fell back into a state of what we would call spiritual apostasy because of the loss of the war.
I'm going to give someone else a chance to jump in here with any questions or comments.
Anything you want to add, Katie?
No, not really.
I'm writing, taking notes here.
Yeah.
So am I.
You know, I might add.
Yeah.
I was going to add, the Myers test, although they did cast about for opinions of other judges in other courts in other nations, it really boils down really to a press release that was sent out or that was made by the IRS, which is really strange because here's a case where procedure in court law comes from the press. It was published in 1978, and let me just go down the list really quickly because the Myers test actually covers most of these things. The IRS requires that a religion, in order to be a religion, has to have a distinct legal existence. It has to have a recognized creed and form of worship. It has to have a definite and distinct ecclesiastical government. It also has to have a formal code of doctrine and discipline, a distinct religious history, and a body of membership, a complete organization of ordained ministers ministering to their congregations, and ordained ministers selected from after or because they've completed an obligatory course of study. They have to have a literature of its own, established places of worship, regular congregations, and regular services. Go down here. And then there are a couple of others. Well, there's one that says they have to have, the IRS said back then, they have to have Sunday schools for the religious instruction of the young, mm-hmm. and schools for the preparation of ministers. Now, many of these things will not stand because, you know, there are churches that have no youth. They're designed for young adults. And some of the other Myers test issues are, do they require special dress? Do they require special diets and special activities and that sort of thing? These kind of things will not stand in a constitutional court or constitutional test because they, you know, there are churches that they just don't, the Quakers, for example, they don't have a specific code of belief, and so this would not work for them. But the one thing that is very important is, even way back when these tests were first compiled, well, let me just quote from the IRC, the IRS code. It says, the above list of 14 church characteristics is not exclusive. Any other facts and circumstances that may bear upon an organization's claim for church status must also be considered. An organization need not have all the characteristics. Few churches do, and newly created churches cannot be expected to. Thus, no single characteristic is controlling. And then again, some of the characteristics may be given more weight than others in a given case. So even the Myers test, the IRS test, they call it a test. But what it does is it provides an individual or a church the opportunity to be able to provide a preponderance of evidence, which is what Myers couldn't do. He made a claim, but couldn't provide any evidence of his claim. These types of devices used in court, their evidence, their procedures in evidence, allow us the ability to create a preponderance of evidence, and that is tremendously useful for people who feel that the practice of natural medicine or healing on any of its levels, whether it be the individual, the family, the community, the society, or the planet, is actually part of their religion. Because if they can establish by preponderance of evidence that it is religious and their sincere belief, then it is protected under the law. And that's a very important thing for those of us who receive the calling as a part of the practice of our religion. We receive it upon revelation, and we're not asking any government for permission to minister emergence and healing on a temporal or spiritual level.
Now, let me ask you a question, Cloudfather. Now that when you establish religion or what we're talking about, the IRS also, I think sometimes when people want to get donations and corporations, and sometimes they require a 501c format, you know, something where, you know, makes you exempt of taxes and things. I'm not sure how the Nemenhal works in that fashion, considering that we have one main church and then we have a bunch of chapter houses. How individual chapter houses, if you require them to have, you know, established, you know, tax, how do you call it? Can't think, but
tax, you know, tax status
with them, or
distinct,
sure,
legal. Distinct legal existence. The church itself is required to have a distinct legal existence, and the church does. Its agencies and associated dependent auxiliaries are not required to have distinct legal existence, because they exist under the charter or constitution or whatever the bylaws of the church are. Now, what I discovered about 501c3 was amazing. In the IRS code, it says that it distinctly states that churches, let me see if I can find it here, churches are a subset of IRC 501c3 organizations organized and operated for religious purposes. But they're not required to register as 501c3s. They have to qualify as a 501c3, but they're not required to actually be one. That's something the IRS doesn't tell anybody. What the auditor first says is, well, you're not a church because you're not a 501c3. But it's not the 501c3 status that is required. It's the 501c3 religious purpose that must be established. Does that make sense? Most of the churches out there have filed for 501c3 status because they're actually operating in commerce. They're commercial operations.
Okay.
But when we discovered that it's not required that the church merely be required to qualify and operate under the regulations of 501c3, but they're not required to register, that was a revelation to us. Mm-hmm. That was an absolute revelation. What that means is that a church does not have to ask permission to exist. But the rules apply. The rules apply for religious organizations, and they apply within a written code called 501c3, but they're not required to register as such.
Okay.
Now, the Nemenha Church has a legal existence in the state of Missouri as a nonprofit organization, not even a nonprofit corporation. It's listed as a nonprofit traditional Native American traditional organization. But under that, under the state laws, the state law requires that you qualify as a 501c3, even if you aren't one, in order to obtain that status, and that's the status they gave us. So we qualified the entire church, all of its chapters, its societies, its orders, everything from the top to the bottom qualify under the IRS rule and also under the Myers test when it comes to, you know, distinct entity requirements.
Okay. Well, so as ministers of the church, there's a difference between a donation and a commerce, because I know they kind of go hand in hand. There's this fine line, this gray area, you know, where you're I don't want to say selling, but you're, you know, no one wants to say you're selling sacraments, but you're offering service of some sort. So, and there's been a lot of confusion here on that in Columbus, so I don't know if you can give us a little clarification on that.
Well, there is some confusion about that. Services, there are two industries in commerce. One is consumables, or what we call a solid industry, and the other is service. And it used to be that services were not taxable, but, you know, in the last 20 years, all services have become taxable. Of course, these are questions for the IRS, not necessarily for, you know, whether you ought to be allowed to practice your religion. But since the court turns to the IRS as its example, or rather its expert when it comes to what is religion and what is commerce, it's wise to look at what the IRS teaches the general public about this. There are two activities, religious activities, that are identified by the IRS. One is an exempt religious activity, which cannot be taxed because of its very religious nature. And then there's a non-exempt religious activity. And those are activities that churches perform that they do that bring in income or earnings that are not attached or not specific to a practice of the church or the practice of the religion.
Mm-hmm.
Like your Catholic bingo, for example, they're really coming under fire right now in a lot of places, in a lot of states, because it's really not the practice of Catholicism to go and play bingo, right? And they take in quite a bit of money. And that's one of the ways that the nice churches are maintained, is because, you know, there's bingo going on, bake sales and stuff like that. Those are actually taxable and therefore not religious activities. They're non-exempt. Mm-hmm. But in terms of practice of natural medicine as the practice of our religion, there's a couple of ways that there's really only one way that it can be done legally, and that is as an essential charity. And this is what gets confusing. A lot of churches out there charge fees, specific fees for their services. But when a church charges a fee for a religious service, it is an exempt religious activity, which means it's really not a fee. They're merely suggesting what the appropriate donation ought to be. If they, say for example, a sacrament, I make a sacrament, somebody requests a sacrament from me, I sell it to a minister. That minister, let's say that I'm Twin Labs, for example, and a minister of the Namenha really is in love with a vitamin C product from Twin Labs. Probably shouldn't use their name, they get upset with us, but mm-hmm. some manufacturer. Mm-hmm. Can I buy that and then use it as a sacrament? Well, yes, but the minister must consecrate the sacrament first, and then it can only be used in the religious service of healing. That means that if I do that, I consecrate, and then I turn around and become a Twin Labs distributor and resell to other Namenha ministers or Namenha parishioners, I would be desecrating the sacrament. And that is a commerce activity, and that's where the confusion lies, a lot of the confusion lies. Namenha have to understand, and I'm hoping that the most of us are beginning to, that we make our contribution to society in healing as an essential charity, and we gratefully receive the sacred giveaway offering that is appropriate. We have to be very, very careful to make that statement, however, and operate that way, because if we don't, if we are buying and selling in commerce, then we simply cannot show by a pattern of behavior that our religion is sincere. We're actually engaged in the religion of buying and selling. The American people, the sovereign of this country, gave authority to government to regulate commerce. It's well within the right of government to regulate commerce. No question about it. Government can't regulate religion, however. So we have to be careful to understand the difference between the practice of our religion and commerce. And that's where we're trying to better educate, use better examples, and do a better job in teaching our ministers and training our ministers how to walk and how to talk in that sacred manner.
Now, is it possible to be in both playgrounds, part of your ministry?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, sure. You can be in commerce, and you have to be careful that you report that commerce and that you play by all the commerce rules. If I'm a medical doctor, for example, and I do medical, allopathic medicine as part of how I make my living, I had better be properly licensed and obey the laws, right?
Mm-hmm.
If as a minister I am also engaged in natural medicine, then that part of my life is my spiritual and sacred life. That operates on a different set of rules. But I certainly couldn't stand up at the pulpit and, speak as or give recommendations as a medical doctor.
Mm-hmm.
That wouldn't, having both feet, having one foot on one side and the other foot in the other, that doesn't work.
I had a question proposed to me the other day. How does a nemenha benefit somebody's practice?
It really depends on how they see their practice. It doesn't benefit a practice in commerce at all. If a person is practicing in commerce, they're abiding by all the laws and they have nothing to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
In the state of Missouri, however, you can think that you're abiding by all the laws and be prosecuted and put in jail without there being a law that you're breaking. They can pull in laws from other states, and that's the way it is everywhere. Natural medicine is really making a lot of money, and when an industry makes a lot of money, government wants its cut. The only way government can get its cut is by regulating it, by causing it to be a felony without specific government permission. It's a substantial burden. Nemenha benefits the practitioner of sacred medicine, one who is attempting to restore the sacred in natural healing, because it provides a way, it provides the avenue whereby they can demonstrate by a preponderance of evidence that what they're doing is not commerce, but it is actually, in fact, the practice of religion. That's the great benefit. Otherwise, how can you do it?
Mm-hmm.
You can say, when I got my degree in naturopathic medicine, I had to kind of give lip service to this idea that healing is physical and it's mental and it's spiritual, because my entire training was physical. It was a teeny tiny little bit of mental and nothing in the spiritual. So the whole industry of naturopathic medicine has turned the corner and is now heading down the medical track because they have abandoned the spiritual aspects of healing. And that was tremendously disappointing to me. My calling was as a healer of the body, the mind, and the spirit. And so the benefit to practice is really depends on what your practice is. If you're running cattle through the stall so that you can sell lots and lots and lots of stuff and rake up lots and lots of people in your office every day, there's no benefit at all because it'll be absolutely useless to you. But if you truly are attempting to heal through emergence, through religious practices with natural medicine as sacrament and sacred object and ceremony, then there's a huge benefit because you can't provide preponderance of evidence on your own.
I'm reminded of Reiki practitioners and people who are, whenever they practice, they're basically forced to say that this is for relaxation or entertainment, or it doesn't have a medical benefit per se. That they can't make that claim for the most part. But even though they might feel that this is a sacred calling to them, that it's a deeply spiritual experience, by law and by the way that things are set up, they can't come forth and say that without, you know, unless they were in the Nemenha or in our organization and were allowed to, under our umbrella, place their sacred healing.
Well, and Reiki is an incredible example of how a modality sold itself down the river. Sensei Osui created Reiki originally as a purely religious practice. And when it came to the Americas, came to Europe and America, it had to be commercialized because who's going to accept that, right? Commercializing a sacred practice throws it into commerce, which is regulable. And so when you take a religious practice like Reiki and you say, okay, you know, this is not religion because I'm not going to call it religion because the American people will never accept that, then you have to throw it out into something else. It's got to be healing. It's got to be professional. It's got to be credible. Well, when you do that, that, you know, you make those compromises, you move into commerce, and that literally is the desecration of the original idea. Nemenha is about restoring the sacred in so many modalities. We are trying to bring it back, and the only way to restore the sacred in something that has lost it is, in a sense, to recreate the wheel, to bring it back into religious practice. There's a benefit there for Reiki ministers, because now they can say essentially and truthfully what they're doing, because it is part of the practice of religion to do so. If the government were to say, no, you can't say that about Reiki, they would be burdening what you're allowed to put into your sermon, how you're allowed to speak about your religion and the representations you're allowed to make that are metaphysical, that are comprehensive, and that are imponderable. Those are slippery slopes that courts cannot step their feet onto. You know what happens when you step on a slippery slope, right?
Goodbye.
You fall on your butt. You fall over, and you slide down the bottom of the hill, and you crash into the fence. I've been there. This is literally what courts talk about when they say slippery slope. But because modalities of healing were stripped away from the religion, the spiritual aspects, because of the advent of science and the importance of being right and showing everybody else that they're wrong, that's where it's taken it. It's taken it right into commerce and into government regulation and essentially voluntary taxation. We have sold ourselves down the river. But if you restore the sacred, you begin to be able to say what is verily true again. You can be honest about it once again, and there is a great benefit to practitioners. What a relief it would be to be able to actually say what is going on, what you can expect, what you can hope for, how you can exercise your faith, even in the workings of the body. That's an amazing benefit.
Do you have a question, Katie?
Well, sort of like a comment, because as I grew up, there are practices that I was taught through my religious practice about the gift of healing, the gift of prophecy, the gift of knowledge, things like that that are spoke about in Scripture, that people are given these gifts, and it's up to us to learn how to use them and practice them according to the laws of the divine. And now... And then when you go to do that, sometimes people get scared away because of sometimes the religious background of it or the nature. But if you say it to maybe those people that aren't in a religion or know scriptures or anything like that, that I'm doing a reading or I'm practicing Reiki or something like, you know, other than the religious aspect of it, then people accept it. But then if you talk to religious people and they say, oh, I have the gift of knowledge, I have a word for you, would you like a reading or something like that, then so I find that you can work with both sides of the fence, the religious people and the non-religious people, by using the gifts that you were given, so to speak, with that, without being commerce, kind of commercey, and then asking for the, you know, the suggested donation in that kind of way instead of, say, this is what I charge, this is cost, which
right.
some people do up front say, oh, this is, I charge $40 for a reading. And I
yeah,
myself personally, yeah, I don't like
that's...
that. I don't like selling my gift. I like saying, if you'd like to give me a donation, then my donations are usually $10 to $50. Or I mean, I don't like putting a price on it, but, you know, something.
Well, you know, that,
the
labor is worthy of his hire. We have a scripture in even the most accepted American religions, Christianity, are going to read the Bible, and the labor is worthy of his hire. But you have to be careful. Individuals. These are the 501c3 rules. We may not need to be a 501c3 entity, but we must abide by those rules. And individuals may not solicit for donations. That's something that practitioners cannot do. Only churches or nonprofits or ministers of churches may actually stand and solicit for donations. So that's why they're charging fees, because they've lost the sacred. They've lost the religion in their practice, and they have to try and translate it in a way that will keep the roof over their head and keep bread in their belly, right? It's not necessary that ministers of religion are paupers or starving because of the services that they render to their parishioners. They are qualified to determine what the appropriate donation is. The appropriate giveaway would be thus. You are qualified and authorized to do that as a minister of religion because there is a code under which you operate, and that's part of the reason we have the Myers test and why it's so important. Individuals cannot establish the validity of or the preponderance of evidence that is an actual religious practice, because they're actually acting in commerce without the backing of religion. And that's where it's, you know, again, a great benefit for practitioners of sacred healing to be part of a religion that doesn't dictate their personal belief systems, but does offer us a code within which we can provide preponderance of evidence of the religious nature of our belief and our sincerity in it. Otherwise, we are men and women at a mark. We have to prove it all by ourselves, and that is tremendously difficult to do in court.
So what would a minister say? Just for example, give us an example. We have a new minister, and he has a website, and he wants to offer his sacred gifts. And how would you, you know, mentor him or her in saying?
Well, let me just, you know, I'm president of the church, but I also have a neighborhood, and I have neighbors who call on me and seek my services as a healer. Let me just give you an example of what I do. I don't have a personal website where I do this, but if I did, I would put on my website the same thing that I say, and that is that as a minister of healing, my services are not for sale, nor are they for hire. I do this as part of the practice of my religion. So you would have to understand in seeking my services, dear one, that you are coming to a minister of religion. Is that okay with you? And they generally say yes, otherwise they wouldn't be calling me on the telephone or standing on my front doorstep, right? The second thing is, now, I don't sell my services, but I do gratefully accept the sacred giveaway or the donation offering of those who seek my services or request relief from suffering under my hand. And the appropriate donation for what you're asking for is. So you see where I'm going with that is that, you know, you are allowed to state what would be appropriate and customary. Well, the individual can say, well, I've considered your suggestion, and I don't think that it's, you know, right, and so I would rather give this. You would then seek guidance of spirit to decide whether that really is appropriate or not, and you are
that's
well within your... Yeah, you're well within your authority as a minister to say, well, that is not the, that's not appropriate in donation. You need to go home and pray about this and seek guidance, and then let's talk, you know, about how we can take care of that. On a website, you're going to find more succinct ways of saying that, but basically it's this, that ministers of religion, they may receive a salary from their church that's called tithe supported or tithe sustained, but they're still consecrating their time and their services to the church. So even the IRS, the bad guy of the universe, mm-hmm. says earnings you receive. Mm-hmm. If you've taken a vow of poverty, you're a member of a religious order, you've taken a vow of poverty. In other words, you're working, you're consecrating your time to religious purpose, then earnings you receive in return for those services are automatically exempt. So they're declaring that what you're doing is religion. However, if you set up a website and you say the fee for this is such and such and the fee for that and you can use your credit card and blah, 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 you have to be tremendously careful because those transactions are actually banking transactions, right? That's why PayPal has created the donate button, because everything else was commerce. And up until just a couple of years ago, the only thing we had to go on if we wanted to utilize the blessing of the Internet at all was commerce. Now, of course, we have other areas. You can actually build it so that they request your services and then make an offering. That's how I operate. I'm out of commerce. I don't charge a fee for anything. But I will recommend what the appropriate offering is and gratefully accept that offering. And quite often, Ignacio, I perform services for no offering at all because a lot of people don't have anything. But they still need the healing, don't they?
Us too. Yeah, the healing.
Yeah, it happens. Yeah, when you're following the Spirit, and the Spirit says, do it. You don't stand around and haggle, do you?
No, you don't wait for the 20 to fall from the sky.
No, it will, but you don't wait, right?
No, you don't.
Right. We act in faith. We step out in faith because there's that much suffering that's going on.
And sometimes a person, if one person can't give you an offering, then the next person that comes along may give you double.
Yep.
Offering to make up for the other person, because that's happened with me before.
And that's happened to me too.
Yeah, so. There is the risk. There's the common doubt and the common fear that we face with practitioners, and the reason that they can't make the step, they can't make the jump to ministry, is because they're really afraid that they won't make a living that way. And you know, it's valid. Mm-hmm. It's totally valid. You really can do so much. Attorneys find very often they can do so much pro bono work that they can't pay their bills and go bankrupt and go work for somebody else, right? But that's not exclusive to religion. You have that in every aspect of life. It really, you know, there's a balancing act that has to be performed. And that's why you are authorized to make a recommendation of what is appropriate and acceptable. And, you know, you just have to follow Spirit. You have to be the minister and not just talk about it.
And it's about living by faith sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are those of us who believe that faith is an actual particle in the universe that holds us all together. So the exercise of faith transcends the bird in the bush that grows out of the mustard seed, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a metaphor for the universe holding together. And so acting in faith, stepping out in faith, thrusting in your sickle for the field is white, exercising faith, these things are big religious doctrinal issues. And the practitioner of healing, whether it be physical, whether what we call practitioner of salvation, temporal salvation or spiritual salvation, enlightenment, you know, you have to take these things into account. You are acting upon your sincerely held belief and your religion. The very act of doing it can be preponderance of evidence that your belief is sincere. It's a it can be a sacrifice to get started in it, because it requires a definite paradigm shift. It requires us to step out of Babylon, come away from Babylon, and touch not the unclean thing. That's what it requires.
I got a question here. Someone asked on the chat room, true health freedom. So I'm not sure what that means, but I think maybe they're asking, is this true health freedom?
I've been thinking about this a lot, because I still get a lot of people who contact me about the health freedom acts that are being pushed for in the States. And I have to look at those and wonder, is that true health freedom? Follow me with this. You know, the trouble with us in our culture is that we don't follow things through to their logical conclusions.
Yeah.
So I was talking with a friend of mine here who is really an advocate of the Health Freedom Act that's being pushed for in legislation in the General Assembly here in the state of Missouri. And I looked at it and I said, okay, basically this act is saying that citizens have the right to choose between traditional allopathic medicine and natural forms of medicine. And that, on the face of it, sounds like freedom, right? You have the freedom to choose. Yay, the government is recognizing our freedom and giving us the ability to choose. But health freedom acts, and I'm using this as an example because he said true health freedom. Is that what this means? Well,
yeah,
it does. But the health freedom acts, the thing that is being advertised out there by attorneys and advocates and activists, doesn't provide health freedom. The government telling a consumer that he's allowed to choose between natural and unnatural medicine does not provide the ability, because these acts do not, they're just, it's too big to provide freedom for the practitioner. So you think about it, if you provide freedom to the citizen, yay, but not freedom to the practitioner, and you relegate, you say instead we're going to do a licensure act, and that's what comes after Health Freedom Acts, is licensure of natural medicine, then what ends up happening is that you pare down the number of colleges out there that are qualified or that are authorized to graduate naturopaths. Right now, there's really only three in the nation. So if you calculate that and you apply that to all the citizens who are, you know, vying for health freedom, it will literally take you 100 years to get 40,000 practitioners. And by the time that 100 years is gone, most of those are out. So you don't have health freedom through legislation. True health freedom comes because it exists already in the practice of medicine. Or, I'm sorry, not the practice of medicine, but the practice of religion. Your medicine is religion. That's where freedom comes, because the Congress passed a law that says we're going to restore to our people what we took from it, from our people previously. That's why this was called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. You don't name an act restoration without acknowledging that you took religious freedom from your citizenry in the past. They did this, and they have strengthened it over the years. So to my thinking, someone like me who believes that natural medicine is a divine calling, the only freedom in health is through religion, through our sincere religious beliefs and practices that are protected under the law. So
okay,
to answer, if we understand, if we interpret the question there properly, is this true health freedom? This, finally, at long last, really is true health freedom, because not only do we provide for the sufferer, the supplicant, but we also provide for the practitioner to be able to practice, to be able to get the sacraments and the sacred objects, to be able to speak and act in a sacred manner. Yes, we provide universally for health freedom.
Any closing thoughts you have that you want to leave with our listeners? I know you've said a lot, but there's probably always something on your mind that you want to share.
Well, I would say to our Namenha members who are listening, or to anybody really, anytime we seek freedom, you have to distinguish between whether you're seeking sovereignty or whether you're seeking freedom. Are you seeking liberty because you're a libertine, or are you seeking liberty because you believe in true freedom or the lack of slavery? That's a thought that's been going around in my mind. Religion doesn't exist very well where there is compulsion, where there is slavery. And basically, commerce has enslaved us. We are literally not good citizens if we don't spend the right amount and in the right way. At some point, most of us are going to turn the corner and say, hey, you know, I don't have to do that. I can believe differently. I can behave differently. That's what stepping out of commerce is about. That's what stepping out or really consecrating means. It means to make a thing sacred again. You consecrate something, you make it holy. But what we've been doing for generations now is making everything that was sacred unsacred. We've been desecrating everything that our ancestors believed was for the very best good of our souls and our bodies. You know, what we do for our souls, we do for our bodies, and what we do for our bodies, we do for our souls. They made that connection. But we have surgically separated our bodies from our souls, and we have only been applying our lives to the body. There, you know, that is a slippery slope. We are going to fall down, and we're going to slip all the way to the bottom of the mountain. And it's going to be a rude awakening when we come up short at the bottom. We need to turn the corner, change our thinking, make a paradigm shift, and return the sacred to our lives. That's my, you know, that's my overwhelming thought for everybody.
All right.
Sit down and make the effort to return or restore the sacred in our lives.
Well, we really appreciate you spending the hour with us.
Yes.
I know there was a lot of information covered. Chief Klapauer, we're honored and we're blessed to have you in our lives. And I'm going to talk to you here in a couple hours. But, yeah, any closing thoughts?
Oh, just my closing thought. I just want to make a statement that, you know, I approached the Namenha without really having a healing modality in mind.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted community. I wanted a connection. I wanted to belong to something I thought was very important, very and touched me deeply in ways, you know, I couldn't even articulate. But I found, you know, through that my own healing has opened up, and I found ways I didn't even imagine that I would be touching people's lives and touching my own inner self in ways through the Namenha. So even if people out there listening don't feel they have a healing calling at the moment, but feel somehow a draw to be a part of this and to find out more about it, I definitely encourage you, because it's enriched my life so much. And I do want to thank you again, Chief Tyler, for initiating this in our modern age and bringing this all together. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're most welcome. It's great privilege for me to be able to do that. I can actually feel like I've accomplished something in my life.
Just to add, my grandparents were the ones that told me about the different gifts and the things in our background and our indigenous heritage, about not to forget where we came from and what we used to practice years and years and years ago. So my mom was taught, and then she passed it down to myself. I hate to say I don't have a child to pass it down to, but somehow or other, maybe just the people I come across with will benefit or see that.
All my relations.
Yes,
we are all your children. Yeah, we're all your children. Pass it on. You pass it down to us.
Mama Katie.
Yeah, so thank you. That's what I think that being a part of the Namenha has done for me. It has helped open doors and my learning to those ancient practices.
Very good.
Nice.
Well, Chief Klapauer, thank you very much. Keep in touch with us. Hopefully we get you back on the show again. So share again some more of your, pick your brain a little bit. A lot of knowledge up there.
That's right.
Well, I love it. Just let me know.
Absolutely.
Well,
thank you very much.
We'll try and land it on a day like today where yesterday we had a tornado went by about 3 miles away, so the phone wouldn't have worked. But today's beautiful. It snowed. Now the sun's out. You know, it's Missouri.
All right. That's why I call it Missouri, right?
Yeah. All right, we'll talk to you in a couple hours, Ignacio.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the show tonight. That was very informative, and I learned a lot. You know,
yes, definitely. I'm sitting here scribbling notes down all the time. And
I always learn something new because there's just so much.
Fountain of knowledge, you know, and sincerity. I mean, it comes across every time he speaks, you know, that he really believes, you know, and it's inspiring for us, you know.
Yeah.
Really sees the vision.
If we could get inside his head, it would be a lot easier, but he has, we have to dictate what he spills out. But,
we don't dictate anything, right?
Well, yeah, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Absorb and,
exactly,
you know, whatever he's sharing with us. Because there's so much that goes on. He does a lot for the Nemenha, and he just makes sure that everybody is on par and par with the information.
What I'm really proud of and impressed with about the Nemenha is that we are the model for a non-tribal, you know, indigenous organization.
Mm-hmm.
What the UN looks to, what the United States looks to, you know,
mm-hmm.
we have set a high bar,
mm-hmm.
and it just gets higher and more, you know, enriched as we go by and we grow ourselves. Truly is a rebirth of a very valuable peoples that still walks the earth today.
You know, what's funny is our other organizations who contact Clapar constantly, mm-hmm. other Native American churches contact him because they find that, you know, there's things that are lacking in their organization.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the roots that we come from, you know, we've blossomed into this amazing,
right.
you know, organization of people. And all the talent that's in it, and just,
and when we strengthen one another like that across those lines, you know, we all grow stronger, you know, as we
absolutely,
you know, as we go forward.
And it's been a interesting ride. It's been a beautiful ride. It's been
that's
a
right.
bumpy ride. It's been all the above for me, mm-hmm. being in the Nemenha. But that's normal, you know, when you're on the front line and doing all the stuff you do and sharing the gifts of the spirit, you know, you're going to get noticed and people are going to point and people are going to laugh and giggle with you.
That's
And that's, you know, that's my calling. That's how I enjoy that. And both of you have been on when our sacred paths have crossed, intersecting and crisscrossing.
We go off and do our own things, and we come together and do greater things.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
It just grows forward, you know. We're sacred clowns.
Yeah, and it's good. And it's good to know that you guys are there. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
When I'm doing my stuff somewhere else, I know I have backing. I have friends, and I can draw from their, you know, energy, their love, and their gifts too, and what they would do. What would they do, or how would they do it? I mean, and being true to myself in the process. But yeah, it's been great. You guys have been wonderful in my life. I don't know if I would have met you, you know, in the way you know, things came around. You know, maybe we would have. I can't say that, but,
so many exciting things coming up. Just even this year, you know, that we're going and we're doing drumming in different places now, and we're reaching out and having, you know, people that maybe wouldn't have been exposed to us, or you know, have. You know, the experience of being around with us. It's great. It's good.
Yeah, and with that, I would say we're done with the show for this week, and we'll move on down the line. Hopefully we can get our friend on here soon enough to actually do an interview with her.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So we can us doing the book interview. But yeah, it'll happen.
Sure.
But any closing thoughts, Katie? Anything you want to add before I put on It's the End of the World?
No, this has been a good, really good show.
Yeah.
I guess that's it then.
Okay.
Ho'oponopono, much love to everybody. We'll see everybody next week.
All my relations.
All my relations.